Evening's talk is entitled John Calvin Part 2, The Indefatigable Reformer. Indefatigable means tireless, someone who is relentless, who will not give up. In the first part of our study of John Calvin, we looked at the young Calvin and we considered his ancestry and birth, his education, the formative influences on his life, both Roman Catholic and then Protestant, and most importantly, his conversion. We saw that after his conversion, he had to flee from Paris and thereafter lived a nomadic existence, travelling from place to place. We saw how God began to use him and how in Basel, on the 10th of September 1535, at just the age of 26, he completed the first edition of his great work, The Institutes of the Christian Religion. In part two, we will be considering Calvin, the indefatigable reformer. And we take up our story with Calvin's departure from Basel in March 1536, just after he had handed his manuscript to the printers for publication. From Basel, Calvin journeyed to Ferrara in Italy. He was travelling with a young companion, Louis de Tillet, who had also been influenced by the teaching of the Reformation. De Tillet said, "We must see Italy." But Calvin's purpose was more than intellectual curiosity. He wanted to visit the Duchess of Ferrara, Renée of France, who had given refuge to friends of the Reformation. She was actually the daughter of Louis XII, and had she been a boy, she would have inherited the French throne. Her husband, Hercule d'Este, at whose hand she would suffer for her Protestant faith, was the son of Lucretia Borgia, daughter of the famous Rodrigo Borgia, who became Pope Alexander VI. Unsurprisingly, d'Este was antagonistic to the gospel and opposed his wife's assistance to the reformers. Through the indiscretion of one of the Duchess's courtiers, Calvin's presence and that of other evangelicals was betrayed, and he was forced to leave Ferrara in Italy after just a few weeks. But not before he had befriended the Duchess, indeed had become her lifelong advisor and spiritual counsellor. From Italy, Calvin made a brief journey to Paris, where he met up with his brother Antoine and half-sister Marie, and where he would settle his estate. There, he set out for Strasbourg, where he intended to lead a quiet life, that of a scholar, never to return to France. Because of the war, however, then going on between Francis I, King of France, and Emperor Charles V, the roads were closed by the movement of troops, and he had to take a detour. His journey took him south through Lyon and then on to Geneva, where he intended to stop for just one night at the Bear Inn. It was the month of July, 1536. Unfortunately for Calvin, his presence was betrayed by du Tillet, and he had a visit from a fiery, red-headed, left-handed French reformer, Guillaume Farel. Farel asked Calvin to stay in Geneva and give himself to the work of the Reformation of that city. Calvin protested his own timidity, that he was best suited for a life of scholarship, and that he could best serve the Reformation through his writings. Farel would not take no for an answer, however. And when Calvin continued to resist, Farel laid upon him a dreadful curse, so that God, he said, would curse his retirement if he didn't give himself to the work. Calvin's commentary on the Psalms, the preface, tells the story in Calvin's own words. "I had resolved," he said, "to continue in the privacy and obscurity of scholarship until at length William Farel detained me at Geneva, not so much by counsel and exhortation as by a dreadful imprecation. which I felt to be as if God from heaven laid his hand upon me to arrest me. As the most direct road from to Strasbourg, to which I intended to retire, was shut up by the wars, I'd resolved to pass quickly by Geneva without staying longer than a single night in that city. A little before this, Popery, having been driven out from it by the exertions of that excellent person, he's talking about Farrell, and also Peter Vire, matters not yet been brought to a settled estate in that city, so it was divided into unholy and dangerous factions. An individual who now basely apostatized to the Roman Church discovered me and made me known to others. Upon this, Farrell, who burned with an extraordinary zeal to enhance the work of the gospel, immediately strained every nerve to detain me. And after having learned that my heart was set upon devoting myself to private studies, for which I wished to keep myself free from other pursuits, and finding that he gained nothing by his entreaties, he proceeded to utter an imprecation that God would curse my retirement and the tranquility of my studies that I sought, if I should withdraw and refuse to give assistance when the necessity was so urgent. By this imprecation I was so stricken with terror that I desisted from my journey which I had undertaken, but sensible of my natural bashfulness and timidity, I would not bring myself under obligation to discharge any particular office in Geneva, that is. It was quite incredible. Farrell had been absent. He'd returned, I think it was the night before. Calvin was just passing through. One day he'd be there, and yet in the province of God, Calvin and Farrell met up, and Farrell constrained him to the work in Geneva. But what was it that was so foreboding about ministering in Geneva? Calvin was indeed shy, timid, introverted, but the bravest of men would have been forgiven for not wanting to serve in Geneva. Though theoretically an independent city for hundreds of years, Geneva had been the seat of a bishop and dominated by the Roman Catholic Church. All that time it had been the subject of a power struggle between the resident bishops and the Genevan counts. More recently, it had fallen under the foreign power of the House of Savoy. Savoy had territories in Italy and France and Switzerland. But it had managed to free itself after a protracted struggle with the help of the city of Bern. The citizens of Geneva were very lax and immoral, and the Roman Catholic clergy were the leaders in this immorality. In fact, Geneva had only declared for the Reformation about 2 months before Calvin arrived, through the labours of Farrell and his colleague Vire. And that at great personal cost to the reformers. They had been beaten, wounded with the sword, poisoned — Vire's health would never recover from being the poisoning — and they'd been expelled from the city. On one occasion, someone had aimed a blunderbuss at Farrell, which had failed to go off, sparing his life. But Geneva had eventually declared for the Reformation in May 1536, following pressure from Protestant Bern and following a great debate between the Protestant reformers and the Catholics to decide the religious question. But why did Farrell want Calvin's help? Farrell had great courage and was a fearless preacher of the gospel. It was said that his voice could prevail above the noise of an organ. But he recognised in the young scholar and author of the Institutes a theological genius with the ability to organise the church, something that he himself lacked. Looking back, Calvin could say at the end of his life that when he first arrived at Geneva, the city was in chaos. There was preaching, but nothing else. Calvin's labours would ultimately transform the city of Geneva. Calvin's beginnings were inauspicious. He was appointed as a reader of Scripture, but such was his low profile among the council that he wasn't paid for the first 4 or 5 months. And when he was referred to the council, referred by the council as that Frenchman. That began to change when he was asked to take part in a debate on the 1st of October 1536 between Catholics and Protestants in the nearby city of Lausanne. This territory had been conquered by Bern, and according to the principle of the time, quis regio, quius religio, whose realm, his religion, in other words, it was your land, it was you decided what, who you're going to worship, it would de facto become Protestant. Nevertheless, the debate would be the means of the facilitation of the acceptance of the Protestant teaching among the people. For the Protestant reformers, Farrell had prepared 10 theses. He would speak on the first thesis on the doctrine of justification by faith, and Viret would address the third thesis on the Roman Catholic teaching of the bodily presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper, which of course the reformers denied. For the Roman Catholics, there were 174 priests present, but only 4 representatives of the Roman Catholic Church would speak, all of them laymen, not one of them a theologian. Calvin kept quiet for 4 whole days. Then, on the 5th of October, a Romanist carefully read a paper that he'd prepared defending the bodily presence of Christ in the Mass, as he called it, and accusing the reformers of ignoring the teaching of the Church Fathers. This was just too much for Calvin, who immediately rose to his feet, quoting several of the Church Fathers verbatim from memory, including Tertullian, Chrysostom, and Augustine, and he utterly confounded the Roman Catholic representatives. So much so that there was complete silence, until the tension was broken by a Roman Catholic monk, Jean Tandy, who got up and before the whole assembly confessed that he had been won over to the reformers' teaching. He was not the only one, and in the months that followed, some 80 monks and 120 priests and clerics were won over to the Protestant faith. It is not surprising that Calvin was soon appointed as one of the pastors of the churches, involved in a regular ministry of teaching and preaching and pastoral visitation. This was demanding work indeed, with 6 or 7 pastors overseeing 13,000 inhabitants of the city in the 7 parishes to which Geneva was divided. Calvin also made an impact on the city council in another way. His hand was largely behind a document referred to as the Articles on the Organization of the Church and its Worship in Geneva, presented by Farrell to the council on the 16th of January 1537. These articles would be the reformers' blueprint for the Genevan Church. The first matter that they dealt with was the celebration of the Lord's Supper. Calvin argued that the supper be celebrated regularly, at least once every Lord's Day. Surprising how important the celebration of the Lord's Supper was to the reformers. Nevertheless, under the present circumstances, Calvin conceded that once a month would be sufficient. Even this would be too much for the council, who insisted just 4 times a year. Moreover, the church must have the right to excommunicate those who lived in open disobedience to the word of God. To facilitate church discipline, the articles proposed the election of a body of overseers, elders, men of good life and reputation from among the faithful, men of integrity, not easily corrupted, who, being scattered in all quarters of the town, may keep an eye on the life and conduct of every person. And if they see any notable vices to be admonished in anyone, let them communicate with one of the ministers, in order to censure whoever is at fault and to exhort him in a brotherly manner to amend his ways. Another article spoke of Christian education in terms of the catechizing of children. This would be done using the catechism that Calvin had already drawn up based on the Institutes. To this was added a short confession of faith, which the inhabitants of Geneva must swear to hold and keep. This was largely a summary of the teaching of the catechism. And anyone who would not adhere to the confession, well, they should go and live somewhere else. Another important point was the singing of psalms in congregational worship. This was one of the great features of the Reformation. It wasn't just the priests and the choirs that would sing, but all God's people would worship him in singing his praise. Now the question must be asked, what was it that the reformers were aiming at? What they wanted was a church that was, under the support of the state, self-governing, and, under the support of the state, composed of real professing Christians. Catholicism insisted on implicit faith. In other words, I believe the church is right, whatever the church says goes, and I don't really, whatever the church says is right, I don't really know what the church says, but I believe the church. The reformers said they must believe the Bible and they must believe the articles of the faith. And they must demonstrate that they were Christians by their godly living. They knew that there would always be tares among the wheat, but they wanted those who did belong to have, at very least, a credible profession of Christianity witnessed by their life and doctrine. Were these demands reasonable? Well, by the standards of the time, they were reasonable. But would they be easy to achieve? Not at all. In the Geneva of Calvin's day, they would only be achieved with the greatest of difficulty. In part, the difficulty lay in the fact that the reformers had to rely on those who governed the city to get their measures passed. And the system of government of the city of Geneva was complex indeed. There was an executive of four men called notaries or syndics. These presided over a little council of 20 men and a larger committee of 60 and a still larger committee of 200. There was a system of checks and balances. And the 200 elected those who served on the little council. In addition, there was a general assembly of all the citizens who had the right to vote, about 1,500 men. And because of the frequent elections, those in power might be at one time favourable to Calvin, and at the next time they would be dead against him. But more importantly, the difficulty lay in what they were asking of the council. The council saw themselves as the God-appointed supreme authority over the city. They alone possessed the power of excommunication. If they yielded this power to the reformers, it was possible that some of them might be excommunicated. And then the order of the city would be disrupted. Moreover, they'd already been under the power of the church in the form of a bishop, and they didn't want a repetition of that situation. So the council dragged its feet. Nevertheless, 3 months later, on the 13th of March 1537, the little council decided, in principle, that the articles should be observed, at least in a modified form. But further trouble developed when it came to implementing them. The members of the council were the first to sign the confession of faith, to set the example. Having done this, they sent leading citizens to go from house to house to ask the head of each house to give his assent to the confession. This proved a total failure. Then on the 29th of July 1537, the Council of 200 ordered that the citizens of every district be assembled at St. Peter's a district at a time, to swear the confession. This was only partially successful, and again there was much dissent, with many citizens absenting themselves. The council now began to show more reserve. In the same month, they rejected Calvin's plan for ecclesiastical discipline, affirming that they themselves were competent to supervise public morality. Moreover, the opposition to the reformers among the general public was hardening. Those that resented having to sign the confession, together with the supporters of Catholicism, were surprised to find themselves so numerous. And this resentment showed itself in the elections of February 1538, where Calvin's opponents easily carried the day. Meanwhile, other difficulties had arisen which tended to diminish the reformers' authority. First, there were Anabaptists who came to the city. These were defeated in public debate by Calvin. More dangerous were the allegations of Peter Caroli, a new pastor at Lausanne, who had taught that prayers should be said for the dead. Naturally, Farrell and Calvin challenged him. Caroli responded by accusing them of denying the Trinity, a terrible accusation, totally without foundation. Caroli challenged Calvin, saying that if he did indeed uphold the Trinity, then he must sign the three of the ancient confessions of the Church, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and that of Athanasius, to prove that he really was a Trinitarian. Surprisingly, Calvin refused. In part, this was because he resented being forced to do something at the hand of a heretic. Moreover, his writings stood on their own merit without any need to be vindicated. But in part, Calvin suspected the legitimacy of the Athanasian Creed, whose confession had not been approved by any legitimate church. And so, he didn't want to put his name to it. Nevertheless, a cloud of suspicion had been raised, particularly in the eyes of the Bernese government. Calvin realised the danger to his reputation and to that of Farrell, and he called for a council to be held at Lausanne, which took place on the 14th of May 1537. And this was followed by another council at Bern the next month. Calvin and Farrell vigorously defended themselves against Caroli and defended their orthodoxy, and Caroli was dismissed from his pastorate. Shortly afterwards, he returned to the Roman Church. Nevertheless, damage had been done to Calvin's authority. The last straw came, however, when the authorities at Bern sought to impose their ecclesiastical order upon the Church of Geneva. Bern held to certain practices that were more Lutheran than Reformed. These included, among other things, the use of baptismal fonts, the use of unleavened bread in the communion, the observance of the Christian festivals, and the way that a bride should attire herself at her wedding. These were all secondary issues. But when the Council of 200 voted to adopt the practices of Bern without consulting the reformers, they felt that this was a threat to their authority over the church. One of them, a blind pastor named Coro, refused to submit and was forbidden to preach. When he did so, he was immediately thrown into jail. Calvin and Farrell protested, and they too were forbidden to preach. They did so in defiance of the council, and they refused to celebrate communion in the present unrest. And following this, on the 23rd of April 1538, the Genevan council met and gave Farrell, Calvin and Coro 3 days in which to leave the city. They left the very next day. Calvin had been at Geneva for just 1 year and 8 months, and to all intents and purpose, his first pastorate had ended in a failure. And this brings us to the second period in Calvin's work as a pastor. His ministry at Strasbourg, which lasted 3 years from September 1538 to September 1541. After leaving Geneva, Calvin and Farrell visited Bern to report what had happened and to seek their help. Surprisingly, they received a warm welcome. Bern was concerned that without the reformers, Geneva would once more fall into the prey of Roman Catholicism. Encouraged by Bern, Farrell and Calvin hastened to a synod that met at Zurich on the 28th of April. Once more they put their case and proposed conciliatory measures whereby they might be reinstated as pastors of Geneva. The council agreed and asked Bern to send an embassy to Geneva accompanying Calvin and Farrell to re-establish the peace. Geneva, however, stood by its decision. Calvin and Farrell were turned back before they reached the city gates. From there, they travelled on foot to Basel. Calvin later wrote to Viré telling him how one of them was nearly washed away in the swollen currents of a flooded river. At Basel, Calvin was lodged at the house of his friend Simon Grinaeus, while Farrell lodged at the printer Jean Oporin. Blind Curro went to minister with Viré at Lausanne. However, on the 4th of October, he was murdered, as we think, believed that he was poisoned. Farrell didn't remain long in Basel. On the 26th of July 1538, he moved to Neuchâtel, where he accepted a call to replace Antoine Marcourt as the pastor. Marcourt, you may remember, was the author of the placards that had caused so much trouble in France. One had been attached to the king's bedroom door, and this caused him to be furious, and persecution was the result. So he had moved to Geneva, and Calvin had taken his place at Neuchâtel. Calvin decided not to follow Farrell, nor would he move to Strasbourg to accept a call that had come from Busse to exercise some small ministry, Parvum Ministeriolum, among the French Protestants who had taken refuge there. Rather, having deemed himself unfit to be a pastor, he would retire from public life and devote himself to a life of scholarship as he had originally planned. In fact, Busse had disapproved of Calvin's obstinacy during his time at Geneva, and Calvin himself had begun to recognise his mistakes as being too intransigent in his demands. He wrote to Du Tillet, "I fear above all things a re-entry into the responsibilities from which I have been delivered, considering the perplexities I had when I was enmeshed therein. I am afraid of tempting God if I take upon myself again such a burden which I have known myself incapable of bearing." Though he had no income, he also rejected the help of Du Tillet, who would eventually return to the Catholic Church. Instead, he sold his books, horror, to make ends meet. Nevertheless, Busse would not be denied. After Calvin had met with the Strasbourg reformers and after Busse had petitioned Calvin with many letters, all of which met with rejection, Busse tried the same approach that Farrell had employed so successfully 2 years earlier, threatening that God would find his Jonah if Calvin persisted in running away. Alarmed by this, Calvin accepted the call to Strasbourg. In fact, Strasbourg would be the making of him as a pastor. Moreover, his time there would not only be fruitful, but also a period of development, enrichment, and personal satisfaction. Particularly important was the Irenic influence of Busse. a man 17 or 18 years his senior. Calvin looked up to Bucer as a friend and mentor, one through whom he could be in touch with the first generation of reformers, a man who had actually been in direct contact with Luther. Calvin had sorted out his systematic theology years earlier, and he would never deviate from it. But much of his pastoral theology he would learn from Bucer. This included his view of four ministries of the church: pastor, teacher, elder, and deacon, the model that he would adopt for his new catechism, which he would later publish in Geneva, 1542, and the liturgy that Calvin would borrow from Bucer, translating the German text into French. Calvin's first collection of psalms was drawn up at Strasbourg, and this was largely modelled after those used by Bucer. Above all, Bucer showed him by his own example how peaceful cooperation of the church with the magistrate might be possible while at the same time maintaining the discipline of the Lord's Supper. It must be said, however, that this cooperation was largely possible because in Strasbourg, Jacob Sturm, leader of the government of that city, was wholly committed to the cause of the Reformation. Geneva would be a totally different kettle of fish. Moreover, it was Bucer who thrust Calvin onto the world stage, introducing him to other reformers at the colloquies that Calvin would attend. From Bucer, Calvin gained a vision for the cooperation between the reformers of the various different persuasions, whether Lutheran or Zwinglian, and a great desire to bring about, if possible, the unification of Protestantism. Calvin preached his first sermon to the French refugees on Sunday, 8th of September, in the church of St. Nicholas aux Andes. He would preside over a flock of some 500 people, considered small for the day. But in Calvin's mind, this flock would be a model for the parishes that would later be created in his beloved France. From the start, he was also asked to teach in a new academy, over which Jean Sturm, no relation to Jacob, had recently been installed as rector. For the first few months, Calvin received no salary and once again would have to resort to selling his books. But he was eventually endowed with the revenues of a chaplaincy and also awarded a florin a week by the magistrates for his teaching. His labours include preaching four times a week and lecturing weekly in the academy. He introduced a liturgy to his flock based on that used by Bucer, and singing of the psalms. His first collection of 18 psalms, seven of which were his own composition, was published in 1539. Calvin maintained the discipline of the Lord's Supper by personally interviewing everyone who wanted to partake beforehand. And remember, there were 500 people in his parish of French refugees. Amid this activity, Calvin also found time to write. He published his first commentary, that on the Epistle to the Romans, dated 18th of October 1538. His goals as an expositor were brevity, simplicity, and freedom of interpretation. In fact, he excelled all the other reformers in his commentaries, including Bucer and even Luther, both of whom could be long-winded and sometimes go off at a tangent. In August 1539, he published his new extended and completely revised edition of The Institutes. This was later translated into French, and if you're interested, it's the copy that the Banner of Truth have recently published. No longer an elaborate catechism, but more a manual of systematic theology. About the same time, he also wrote his little treatise on the Lord's Supper. This was an independent interpretation of the communion service that sought to mediate between the positions of Luther and Zwingli. There's a story that Luther actually saw this at a shop of a Wittenberg bookseller, and having flicked through it and read through some of the pages, he commented, "He is a man of faith and scholarship. If Zwingli and Ecolampadius had dealt with the business as he does, the dispute would have been shorter and less bitter." Another important work published soon after this was Calvin's letter to Sadoleto. In 1538, Sadoleto, a Roman Catholic cardinal, had written to the people of Geneva, inviting them to return to the Roman Catholic fold, affirming that this was the true church, with 1500 years of tradition behind it. He said that the reformers had introduced novelties, that they were self-seeking in their goals. And he asked the authorities at Bern to reply. Calvin did so in just 6 days, remarkable, writing a witty, profound answer to Sadoleto that confirmed the Genevese people in their stance on the Reformation. In August 1540, another life-changing event took place for Calvin when he married Idelette du Beur, the widow of an Anabaptist who was one of Calvin's first converts. Bucer had suggested that Calvin should marry and had sought to find him a wife. Calvin said that if he did marry, are you listening, bachelors present, it would be, he wanted to find someone who would be modest, obliging, not arrogant, thrifty, patient and careful for his health. He found what he was looking for in Idelette. He wanted to marry in order to devote more time to his service to the Lord. Farrell travelled from Neuchâtel to Strasbourg to conduct the service, and in spite of its apparently unromantic beginnings, the marriage proved to be a very happy one. In the words of one brother here present, he found someone saved, sound and sensible. And it's amazing how these reformers went for a godly woman, and love came with the relationship developing as time went on. It wasn't a Hollywood idea of romance. Calvin grieved deeply when 9 years later his wife died. Idelette had 2 children, a boy and a girl, by her first marriage. But the only child that she bore to Calvin, a boy named Jacques, died just a few days later. When reproached about this by one of his adversaries, Calvin remarked that God had given him children all over the world. Bucer also helped Calvin by sending him to the various colloquies which the Emperor Charles V had organised with the aim of reunifying the church. Calvin had got no hope whatsoever that this reunification would take place, and he actually scorned the attempts of some of the other reformers to compromise. He was not for compromise. But he did go to Frankfurt in April 1539, to Hagenau in June 1540, and to Worms in November 1540, each time sent by Bucer as an observer. But at Ratisbon in April 1541, Bucer insisted that his young colleague should be recognised as an official Strasbourg delegate. Not only did Calvin get an inside knowledge of the German Lutheran churches at these colloquies, but his own theological genius became widely recognised, and he made friends with some of the other reformers, including a lifelong friendship with Philip Melanchthon. Thus, Calvin's time at Strasbourg proved to be a great blessing to him and to the church at large. But it wasn't to last, because as he approached the end of the 3rd year of his Strasbourg ministry, things had begun to change at Geneva. The new pastors who had replaced Farrell and Calvin had rendered complete obedience to the wishes of the Genevan Council, acquiescing in the Bernese ceremonies, admitting all and sundry to the Lord's table without examination. But their incompetence and the lack of discipline had left the city in disarray. As early as the 19th of February 1539, less than 10 months after the expulsion of the reformers, a complaint was made to the council of scandalous conduct among the people of Geneva, including the singing of lewd songs, blasphemy against God, and even some running around naked in the streets. Thus, less than a year after Calvin's departure, there had been a debate as to whether or not he should be recalled. The party that supported Farrell and Calvin, known as the Guillaumines, after Guillaume Farrell, argued that the expulsion of the two reformers had been a mistake, and they laboured for their return. Their opponents, known as the Artichodes, after the articles that they had drawn up, wanted peace with Bern. These articles, however, surrendering Genevan rights to Bern, were viewed as a betrayal and caused great unrest. Unsurprisingly, on the 20th of May 1540, the Guillaumines came to power on the council, and soon after, three ambassadors who had signed the articles with Bern were condemned. One of the four leaders of the council who had expelled Farrell and Calvin was beheaded for riot and bloodshed, and the other three had fled the city. The time-serving pastors would also leave. On 21st of September, the little council voted that Calvin be restored. On the 19th of October 1540, the Council of 200 decided to use all means to secure Calvin's return. And on the 20th of October, an official embassy was sent out for Strasbourg to solicit Calvin's return to Geneva. He wasn't there, he was at one of the colloquies, and they followed him. Calvin had no wish to return. He told them, "I've got a ministry at Strasbourg, which I cannot leave unless I am discharged by the Saviour." He had said in a letter to Farrell, "I should prefer 100 other deaths rather than this cross on which I would have to die 1,000 times a day." Bucer and his colleagues had no desire to lose Calvin, but they did agree that he could return to Geneva for a time only. Viret urged Calvin to return, and Farrell once again was insistent, warning Calvin with threatenings similar to those he had employed when first summoning Calvin to Geneva. At last, Calvin agreed, writing to Farrell and avowing, "I am not in my own power. I offer my heart as a sacrifice to the Lord. I yield my soul, chained and bound, unto obedience to God." Looking back in the preface to his commentary on the Psalms, he wrote, "Necessity was laid upon me of returning to my former charge, contrary to my desire and inclination. The welfare of this church, it is true, lay so near my heart that for its sake I would not have hesitated to lay down my life. But my timidity nevertheless suggested to me many reasons for excusing myself again, willingly taking upon my shoulders such a heavy burden." It's interesting to notice how Calvin was so decisive when it came to issues of doctrine, but when it came to guidance, it's almost as if he had to be pushed by the other reformers, whose opinion he highly valued. This brings us to Calvin's final period of ministry at Geneva, 13 September 1541 to 27th of May 1564. When Calvin left Strasbourg on the 2nd of September 1541, he literally sobbed. When he arrived at Geneva on 13th of September, 11 days later, he was filled with dread. He was right to be apprehensive. He would have to endure 14 years of struggle before he would enjoy 9 years of triumph. Nevertheless, when he re-entered the city of Geneva, all seemed well. He received a great welcome from the people and from the magistrates. He was awarded an annual salary of 500 florins. A house would be purchased for him on the Rue des Chanoines, the Street of Canons. Moreover, transport was provided for Calvin's wife and daughter, who would prudently remain behind at Strasbourg. And the very first Sunday, when he re-entered the pulpit and he commenced preaching where he'd left off all those years later, the exact place, the church was full. The battle lines were drawn, however, from the start, because on the very day of his arrival, Calvin demanded that he be allowed, together with a commission of pastors and advisers, to draft a plan of reorganisation of the church. This document, known as the Ecclesiastical Ordinances, was drawn up by the 20th of September, shortly after Calvin's arrival. But it was not adopted by the council until the 20th of November, 2 months later, when they had made considerable changes. The ordinances were based on the four ministries of the church as Calvin understood them, those of pastors, teachers, elders, and deacons. Pastors were to be nominated by their colleagues, approved by the council, and agreed by the people. The council insisted, however, that they have a say in the initial choice. Calvin gave way. Pastors were to be set apart by the laying on of hands. The council vetoed this. Calvin gave way. The primary work of the pastor was to preach the word of God and to administer the sacraments. Preaching would take place at the churches of Geneva, St. Peter's, St. Gervais's, and La Madeleine. At least one sermon would be preached every day. The Lord's Supper was to be celebrated once a week. This was a demand too much for the council, who restricted communion to four times a year at the great festivals and in the autumn. Again, Calvin gave way. The company of pastors would meet together once a week for Bible study and mutual admonition. Council couldn't say anything against this. And then teachers. Teachers were responsible for the instruction of children, for the training of pastors. The former were to be taught at a school and the latter were to train at a school of theology, which initially would be held in Calvin's own house, with Calvin being the sole tutor. Children were also to be instructed every Sunday from a new catechism, which Calvin hastily drew up in a matter of 8 days. He said, Vire was then in the city, but I didn't have time to consult him. I just wrote down pages at a time, handed them to the printer, and off they went to be printed. Elders were to serve alongside the pastors on the consistory, a body that would oversee the people, watching over their lives and doctrine, admonishing the weak and fallen with a view to winning them back. 12 elders would be nominated, and nominations would be made by the little council, not, as Calvin had wanted, by the pastors. Moreover, the elders would be chosen from the members of the council, presided over by one of the syndics. So the consistory became a sort of a quasi-political body, and Calvin is blamed for instituting a sort of inquisition where one woman was rebuked for praying over the grave of her dead husband, and another because she went to see a fortune teller and other things. But there were very serious crimes such as adultery and immorality, and very often these were referred to the council. The consistory would meet once a week to review the cases presented to them and to admonish offenders. For really serious offenders, such as adultery and fornication, Calvin insisted that the pastors and elders had the right of excommunication. The council said no, but on this point, Calvin would not give way. Finally, deacons were to be elected in a similar manner to the elders. Their role was to manage the church funds and to look after the sick and elderly. A charity hospital was to be set up, and a physician and a surgeon were appointed to work in the hospital and to attend the homes of the poor. Thus, when the ordinances were finally accepted, Calvin had got more or less what he wanted, except that a clause was added by the council that effectively gave the council the final say. Nevertheless, Calvin had set out his platform by which the work of the Reformation should go forward. After the first month back, Calvin was exhausted. Not only had he drawn up and battled over the ordinances and drawn up a new catechism, but along with an extensive correspondence, he had also engaged in a demanding ministry of preaching and lecturing and writing. In the time that's left, I want to say something about the struggles that Calvin had in the first 14 years to establish his reforms. And then I want to look at the triumphs and the accomplishments that Calvin knew in the 9 years of his life that were left. First then, the 14 years of struggle. Calvin's troubles arose from the various opponents and various sources of opposition that he encountered. One of his first battles was fought with Sebastian Castellio, the rector of a school at Geneva. Castellio was doubtless good at his job, but with a growing family, he soon found that his wages were inadequate, and early in 1542, to supplement his income, he applied to become a pastor. In this, however, he was opposed by Calvin. It wasn't that there was anything wrong with his life or doctrine, but Calvin felt that certain issues disqualified him. Castellio had made a translation of the scriptures that used language that was described as debased and shocking. More importantly, he had denied the inspiration of one of the books of the Bible, the Song of Solomon, saying that it was an obscene composition describing the amorous lusts of its author. Calvin suggested that to accommodate his needs, Castellio's salary be raised. But this was not enough for Castellio, who quit his job and left for Basel, not before having denounced Calvin and his colleagues as gluttonous, drunken, and wanton playboys. I don't know where he got that from. Despite the fact that Calvin had furnished him with the letters of commendation, in all this, it was the Genevan school that suffered. But far worse opposition was to arise from a group who Calvin called the Libertines. These were a group of patriotic, aristocratic families who had helped to free Geneva from foreign rule and who had initially welcomed the Reformation. In time, however, their loose morality had caused them to come to resent Calvin, whom they saw as a foreigner who sought to foist his morality over their city. In particular, they resented the consistory of which they fell foul. And they also resented the influx of French refugees who would flock to the city, fleeing from persecution and also attracted by Calvin's preaching. One of the earliest attacks came from Pierre Ameau, a manufacturer of playing cards. Ameau's grievances against Calvin were twofold. The little council had banned the use of cards, damaging Ameau's trade, for which he blamed Calvin. And then Ameau had wanted to divorce his wife, whose conduct was adulterous to say the least. Though the divorce was ultimately granted 18 months later, Calvin had hesitated for a great while, and Ameau was enraged. At a dinner with friends, all his ire came to the surface, and he spoke bitterly against Calvin and his teaching, saying that he was a wicked seducer. This was perceived as an attack upon scripture, and the little Calvin forced Ameau to walk through the city, candle in hand, without coat or hat, and at three places to fall on his knees and plead for mercy. In fact, this probably brought some sympathy for Ameau. Even worse opposition came from a well-to-do family, that of Francoise Favre. of loose morals, they felt that their social standing put them above the law. But they were soon to learn that this was not the case. Francoise was excommunicated by the consistory for gross immorality. His son Gaspard was detained by the council for a similar offence. He said that if ever he became a magistrate, he would establish places of debauchery throughout the city. When he was set free, at the first opportunity, he sought to interrupt Calvin's preaching by pretending to play skittles, sound effects and all, during the sermon. On another occasion, he played sport with his friends outside St. Peter's while Calvin was preaching inside. More fierce was Francois' daughter, Franchiquine, wife of another distinguished citizen, Ami Perrin. Calvin called her Penthesilea, queen of the Amazons. Accustomed to kick her mother-in-law, she was arrested by the council for lewd dancing at a wedding. Sent to the consistory for a reprimand, she flew into a hysterical rage, venting her spleen on Calvin. Following further conflict, both father and daughter fled from the city. But Calvin worked for their repentance, and ultimately, formally at least, they were reconciled to him. Even more of a thorn in Calvin's side was Ami Perrin, the comic Caesar, Franchiquine's husband, who would become leader of the Libertines. A member of the council and commander of the militia, he had been one of those who had called for Calvin's recall. But he took offence when the little council forbade his infantrymen the wearing of the fashionable slashed breeches. Wonderful, as you can see. The council deeming them too luxurious. On another occasion in 1547, when sent by an ambassador to Henry II, the new French king, he turned out to be a terrible man, Perrin was accused of secret negotiations with the French. He was deposed of his offices, and in retaliation he made counter-accusations against Laurent Maigret, one of Calvin's friends, and had him thrown into prison. More serious confrontation resulted when, together with two of his colleagues, Pierre Vandel and Philibert Berthelier, he raised a rabble outside a meeting of the Council of 200. Calvin, who happened to be there, perceiving their desire for blood, interposed his own body, saying, "If you must shed blood, let mine be the first." The riot was quelled. It carried on inside the council, but again, Calvin quelled the unrest. Another infamous act that took place in 1547 was a death threat that was found pinned to Calvin's pulpit in Saint-Pierre. The author was Jacques Gruet. Earlier that day he had dined with Franchiquine Perrin, and evidently his feelings against Calvin had been stirred. When apprehended, he denied the offence, but his house was searched and blasphemous papers and treasonous correspondence was found. He was tried and beheaded, and in 1548 things got worse when Vandel and Berthelier organised an opposition party wearing a white cross as a symbol of their affiliation and resistance to Calvin. His opponents felt free to harass him however they pleased, ringing handbells in the night and firing blunderbusses, calling their dogs Calvin, or shortening Calvin's name to Cain. In February, the elections of 1549, the Libertines had gained complete control over the council. Perrin had his offices restored, and Vandel had become Attorney General. To top it all, on the 29th of March 1550, Calvin's wife, Idelette, died. Outwardly, he retained his composure, but inwardly, he was grieving, and he poured out his sorrows to his friends in letters. God had not forgotten his servant, however, and that year, the number of refugees, particularly French refugees, fleeing to the city showed a marked increase. Among them was Theodore Beza, who would be Calvin's right-hand man and ultimately his successor. Moreover, though Calvin continued to suffer, relief would not be long in coming. Things came to a head in 1555 when all four of the syndics were chosen from Calvin's supporters. In part, this was due to reaction against the excesses of the Libertines, and in part, it was due to the French refugees who had gained seats on the Council of the 200. The Libertines were not finished in their opposition because some of their number still held important positions within the city, but they were becoming more and more desperate. On the night of 16th of May, 1555, Perrin, Vandel and the Berthelliers met for a meal in a tavern. It's not clear whether they were plotting a rebellion or, more likely, they'd just become drunk and got carried away. At any rate, they rose from their table and headed towards a house which they thought was full of Frenchmen intending to burn it down. Unfortunately for them, one of the syndics lived next door, and when he tried to intervene, they brushed him aside, and Perrin snatched away his official baton, this being perceived as an act of treason, seizing power. And when another syndic arrived and tried to arrest Perrin, take him to the town hall, all turned tail and fled, several of the leaders eventually leaving the city. Tried and condemned in their absence, they were not to return. Others of their supporters were not so fortunate, and some were condemned to death. The upshot was that all the organised resistance to Calvin was over, and Calvin would enjoy 9 years of relative peace. Before we come to those last triumphant years, however, we need to consider a matter that has brought great distress to Calvin's supporters and has given ammunition to Calvin's opponents even to this day, the burning of Michael Servetus. On the one hand, Servetus was a man of great learning who had studied law, mathematics, and who had practiced medicine. But on the other hand, he could only be described as a raving fanatic, who lived in a fantasy world of his own making. Having developed an interest in theology, he came to think of himself as the corrector of Christendom. In 1531, he published a book, De Trinitatis Erroribus, on the errors of the Trinity, and he sought to foist his views on such reformers as Ecolampadius and Bucer. At Basel, he was ordered to retract his teaching. He did. He wrote a new book, Dialogorum de Trinitate, Dialogues on the Trinity, different from the first, but just as dangerous and deadly. The Spanish Inquisition ordered his arrest. He disappeared, changing his name to Michael Villeneuve. In 1545, he began to write to Calvin with questions on the Trinity and on the teaching of the Church. Calvin replied. Servetus wrote again, disputing Calvin's answers. Calvin wrote again at greater length and sent him a copy of the Institutes. This was returned with rude comments and disagreements scribbled all over it. Moreover, Servetus wrote a new book, Christianismi Restitutio, The Restoration of Christianity. It's no coincidence that it sounds like the Institutes of Christianity, because it was a direct assault on Calvin's Institutes and also on other reformers such as Melanchthon. Calvin wrote to Farrell saying that Servetus wanted to come to Geneva to teach him something astonishing and unheard of. But Calvin said, "I do not wish to pledge my word for his safety. For if he comes, I will never let him depart alive if I have any authority." T.H.L. Parker thinks that Calvin may well have written to Servetus in these terms, warning him not to come. To cut a long story short, Servetus was discovered and imprisoned by the Roman Catholic authorities in Vienne. He escaped, but he was sentenced to death in his absence. This is by the Roman Church. Drawn like a moth to the flame, however, he headed for Geneva, only to be reported to the council by Calvin's secretary, Nicholas de La Fontaine, having been spotted in St. Peter's listening to Calvin. In a long, protracted trial, Calvin demonstrated the heretical nature of Servetus' teaching and the fact that he was seeking to corrupt others with his heresy. It wasn't just the fact he was a heretic, but he was actively trying to subvert the church. The council wrote to the cities of Bern, Basel, Zurich and Schaffhausen, all of whom condemned Servetus. On the 26th of October 1553, Servetus was condemned to be burned at the stake. Calvin pleaded that he die by the sword and be spared the flames. His pleas fell on deaf ears. Right to the end, Calvin reasoned with Servetus, trying to get him to change his mind to repent. Servetus would not listen and ended his life denying the deity of Christ. He prayed to Jesus, Son of the Eternal God. He should have prayed to Jesus, Eternal Son of God. It was a deliberate statement of his anti-Trinitarian teaching. The question is, can Calvin be justified for his part in this sorry affair? The answer, from the perspective of the vast majority of evangelical and reformed Christians today, is decidedly not. However, I want to say a few words in Calvin's defence. First, Calvin always maintained that his authority as a pastor was the authority of the Word, and as we read in Romans 13:4, the authority of the sword belonged to the state, not to him. Second, the state believed that someone who corrupts people's faith by teaching heretical doctrines was worse than a murderer, because the heretic was a murderer of souls. Thirdly, like all the magisterial reformers, Calvin believed that the Christian state had a duty to uphold the church, to establish and maintain true religion in the world. And the church had a duty to cooperate with the state. Now, if you think about it, it was a totally different world than the world that we live in today. Calvin and the other reformers would never have dreamed of the secular state that we have today. For over 1,000 years, there had not been a secular state. The state was the upholder of the law of God in its own eyes. But having said that, with the benefit of hindsight, we would not condone the taking of Servetus' life or others like him. Having touched on this thorny issue, I want to conclude on a positive note by considering the vast accomplishments of Calvin, particularly the triumphant last 9 years. And in considering this, we need to think of the magnitude of his labours. Truly, he sacrificed his life in the service of the church. In the morning, following his devotions mind, he would be at his desk at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And he would labour well into the night. He never had 2 hours, he said, when he didn't have an interruption from one person or another. In fact, he got such a memory that he could be dictating a letter, he'd be interrupted, and then he'd remember exactly where he was and he'd resume at exactly that point. He probably preached about 6 times a week or more, and he lectured weekly on the Old Testament, lecturing directly from his Hebrew Bible, which there and then he translated into Latin for the students. He regularly attended meetings of the Venerable Company of Pastors, this was weekly, and the consistory, and occasionally he would speak to the council. He wrote commentaries on nearly every book of the Bible. He produced one of the greatest systematic theologies ever written, the Institutes of the Christian Religion, besides countless books and tracts. And added to this, He had an enormous correspondence. About 4,000 of his letters are extant, and it has been estimated that he wrote double this amount. And the amazing thing about this is that he completed all his work not only amidst an unceasing opposition that we've thought about, but also amidst the continuous problems that he suffered with his health. He always suffered from headaches and from indigestion, but in later years he also suffered from the gout, from kidney stones, several of which he passed with great discomfort, from nephritis, from quartan fever, from ulcerated hemorrhoids, from tuberculosis, from hemorrhaging and painfully diseased joints. And he insisted on working right to the end of his life. He preached and taught even when they had to carry him into his pulpit. And we could expand on his labours ad infinitum. But I want to close with just two of his accomplishments. The first was the building of the academy at Geneva. And this was always one of Calvin's aims from the time he had penned his ordinances. But for many years, his attempts to establish a school and an academy struggled. In his last 9 years, however, he lived to see his plan come to fruition. In January 1558, the council decided to take the matter in hand. By March, they had found a suitable site. But the work didn't start until the end of the year. It was to go on for a further 5 years, well after the dedication ceremony on the 5th of June 1559. So they were having lectures and the workmen were in sawing away or whatever they did. However, the academy was more than stone and wood. It needed a supply of teacher. Beza would be the rector, and in the province of God, a dispute with Bern caused the teaching staff at Lausanne to resign. Calvin would find employment for them in Geneva. The college accommodated 1,000 pre-university students and an academy of 300 undergraduates who trained for the ministry or for civil government. Pastors would be sent out from Geneva all over the world, many to Calvin's beloved France. He would say, "Send us the wood and we will send you back the arrows." This brings us to the final point, Calvin's leadership of the Reformed Church. Calvin guided the churches largely by his writings, his commentaries, his sermons, and his institutes were enormously influential, and they're still influential to this day. To these he added tracts and letters. Nearest to his heart was the evangelical church in his beloved France. One of Calvin's first attempts to help them was his tract written to the Nicodemites, Christians who would not take a decided stand for the gospel, whether because of fear of persecution or through a desire to retain their living within the Roman Catholic Church. Calvin reminded such that Nicodemus came to Jesus by night before he was converted, but afterwards, when he came to confess Christ openly, he came by day at great peril to anoint the body of Jesus. They didn't need to court persecution, but they must be obedient to God's word. Another way that Calvin guided the church was by his comfort and consolation of those who were persecuted. On one occasion, several young men travelled from Lausanne to Lyon. They fell foul of the authorities because of their faith and were arrested. Calvin laboured to have them released. When at length they were sentenced to death, he wrote a letter of deep comfort and consolation to them, encouraging them to trust in God, who would give them grace to face the flames. But one of Calvin's greatest contributions was the growth of the churches was by sending them books and by sending them pastors. Increasingly, groups of Christians began to organise themselves into churches, doing so along the lines of Calvin's model. In 1559, a national synod met in Paris, this was at the height of persecution, representing some 50 churches or more. They drew up a confession of faith based on that of Geneva, and a system of church government And throughout his life, Calvin offered advice and guidance. When the Duke of Guise tried to, well, horrendously persecuted the French Christians, he advised them not to take up arms, but they didn't listen. Calvin's interest in the church was international. It reached to England, Scotland and Poland, as well as the churches of Switzerland and Germany. He wrote to reformers, bishops, statesmen, kings and queens. He wrote to Queen Elizabeth I. He wrote to Edward VI. He wrote to the Protector Somerset. He wrote to other reformers. He wrote to Luther, who never received his letters. And he never ceased to labour for the unity of the evangelical church. He was largely responsible for the consensus that was reached with Zurich on the Lord's Supper in 1549, adopted by the Swiss churches. To Thomas Cranmer, who was trying to organise the churches, he said that if he could be of service in drawing the churches together, he would willingly cross 10 seas to do so. Cranmer's efforts came to nothing. Early in 1564, Calvin's health deteriorated. He wrote his will on the 25th of April, leaving what he had to his relatives and also to a boys' school. He had practically nothing. He left a silver cup to Antoine, his brother, and a few gold coins to his relatives and to the boys' school. People said that he was avarice and ambitious and wanted to make his fortune. He said, "I haven't got enough money even to buy a small plot of land." The house and the furniture were all belonging to the council. Before he died, he was visited by the council, who talked to him, and he spoke to them on the 27th of April, and by the pastors the next day. The 80-year-old Farrell travelled from Neuchâtel to see him. Calvin had written to him in the greatest of ill health to say don't come, but Farrell came. He died on the 27th of May 1564 at about 8 o'clock in the evening. Beza said that on that day, at the setting of the sun, a splendid luminary was withdrawn from us. He was buried in a common cemetery in an unmarked grave at his own request, almost the whole city turning out to bid him a tearful farewell. He was just 54 years of age. May God, in his mercy to the church, raise up such men in our day. Thank you.